This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
So the prime example right now, they've submitted a biochar methodology to the Alberta Offset Scheme, which is mostly geared towards offsetting the tar sands emissions, the emissions from tar sands extraction in Alberta, which is one of the worst, most destructive, most polluting projects on the surface of the earth. And they're saying, you know, you could use bury some biochar in the ground to offset that pollution, which is really pretty outrageous given how little we know about the reliability of biochar, for one thing, and secondly, given that offsetting pollution is not, you know, a viable approach to dealing with the climate crisis at this point. We need to actually get rid of those emissions and those sources of pollution.
And the trees that they're looking at commercializing are actually eucalyptus trees, which, first of all, are not native to the North American continent or anywhere in the world except for Australia. But industry loves them because they're fast growing. And so they've been manipulating them to be cold tolerant so that they can actually grow all along the Gulf Coast of the United States, where they've never been able to grow before. And we believe it's very dangerous. Not only are these things very invasive, as anybody in California already knows, but they're extremely flammable, and they suck up a lot of groundwater. You know, wildlife can't live in these places, and yet, you know, international paper is talking about doubling the acreage of plantations in the southeast from 42 million acres to 84 million acres using these genetically engineered eucalyptus trees.
You know, just to think that one accident contaminated a whole continent is just almost beyond belief. And it's going to happen again. And I may say that the next nuclear meltdown, if it's in a Western country like Europe or America, that will mark the end of nuclear power. That'll be it.
This is Alex Smith with Radio EcoShock. We are filling in for Earthbeat host Daphne Washam, who is trying to raise sufficient funds to return to the air. On today's broadcast, you will get a taste of the kinds of interviews Daphne has done and continues to do for us as a volunteer for Radio EcoShock. If you would like to see both Radio EcoShock and Earthbeat continue with this kind of reporting, please visit the earthbeatradio.org website to find out how you can contribute. On today's program, two important new interviews from Daphne on the road. Rachel Smoker will describe a developing scheme to use untested biochar theory to offset the dirty tar sands in Canada. Is biochar for real? Then Daphne talks with Ann Peterman about industrializing our forests with genetically engineered trees. Once they are out there in the wild, there is no return. We'll wrap up with the Best of Earthbeat interview with Dr. Helen Caldicott, who explains the big risks in nuclear power long before the reactors at Fukushima, Japan, melted down. In our first interview, you get a new look at biochar and the big companies who want to sell it as a solution to climate change.
This is Daphne Washam. I'm speaking with Rachel Smoker. She's the co-director of Biofuel Watch. And Rachel, you've just come out with a report on biochar. I wonder if you can explain for our listeners, first of all, what is biochar?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's one that we actually found was more difficult to answer than we thought. Biochar, the idea is that you take some kind of biomass, like some wood, for example, and you burn it with limited oxygen, and you get essentially charcoal. This is how we make charcoal, traditional charcoal as well. But the word is usually used to refer to taking that charcoal and burying it under soil. In other words, it's defined by how it's used rather than what the material is, really. Most of the time, the idea is that by burying that charcoal, which has a lot of carbon in it, you can bury it underground and sequester the carbon away from the atmosphere, which is part of the reason why it's been promoted as a solution to climate change. The reality is that most of the biochar that has been tested is either charcoal that's been made through traditional charcoal processes or charcoal that's left over even from Swidden agriculture, slash and burn agriculture, or wildfires, naturally occurring wildfires.
if biochar were to be used on a large scale, it would be produced using pyrolysis facilities, which, you know, are just burners, essentially, that have the ability to control the temperature and the oxygen flow. And what people are finding is that the very particular details of how this material, the characteristics, the chemical and structural characteristics of this material actually make a huge difference in how it behaves in the soils. Because, you know, you can get anything from very fine particles to particles that have, that still retain a lot of the structure of the material that it was made from the wood, you know, the structure of the wood. It really is very variable, and it depends a lot on what it's made from, what temperature it's raised to, how quickly it's cooled, and other factors.
So where is the push for the use of biochar coming from? Who has such an interest in promoting biochar as a so-called solution to climate change?
Well, it's kind of grown out of, I'd say the main body is the International Biochar Initiative, which is kind of a conglomeration, if you will, of academics, soil scientists. There's also carbon market consultants and some bioenergy companies, startup companies that are involved with that. It's kind of a hybrid organization. And there's also just a lot of, I don't know, enthusiasts, I would say, who are looking for some kind of a, you know, viable, farmer-friendly solution to climate change.
And is this a viable farmer-friendly solution?
Well, I would say no. You know, I think, of course, farmers have the right to try it and see how it works. But we just did, in this report, we did a review of some of the scientific research that's been done. And we especially focused on field studies because we feel that the only meaningful results are studies that come from using natural soils, not sterile soils. They're not under laboratory conditions. They're under natural, you know, conditions that would happen in the real world. And there's very few of those studies, actually, it turns out. There's only about 13 peer-reviewed studies. 11 of those are based on 11 different field trials that have been done in different places around the world. And the results from those have been incredibly mixed, you know, ranging from really astonishingly poor results to, in some cases, you know, showing that some carbon had been retained in the soil or that yields had been increased. That's another claim that's made about biochar is that it improves the fertility of the soil and therefore, you know, you get better crop growth from soils that biochar has been added to. Those are really the two main claims that are made about it, sequestering carbon and increasing soil fertility. And so those were the two things we really looked at closely, and we found the results to be very, very mixed, and very mixed in very surprising ways. There were some, for example, on one study that was done in Colombia, where they added really enormous quantities of biochar, I think it was something in the order of 20 tons per hectare, and came back, you know, 2 years later and found that there was no elevation in the soil carbon. So, and then there's other studies where there does appear to be some elevation in the soil carbon, but it's very mixed. And part of the reason it's mixed is because some of that biochar apparently is lost to wind and water erosion. Some of it migrates deeper down into the soils where it can't be really found anymore, and some of it ends up just oxidizing and being lost back out into the atmosphere. In other words, it's labile, it's not stable. And, you know, you have to realize that the biochar enthusiasts are claiming that biochar will sequester carbon reliably in soils for hundreds or even thousands of years. So it's really important to look at the field studies and see what the results are supporting those claims. And they're astonishingly weak at this point.
So what's the danger here? I mean, it sounds like the studies are mixed. There are some studies that suggest carbon may be sequestered in the soil, others that suggest it may not. Why not just let the scientists continue with their studies and see where all the dust settles eventually?
Well, that would be fine, you know, if some scientists wanted to continue to study biochar, that would be no problem. But the thing is, they're advocating for this as a very large scale. Their vision is to scale this up, you know, as a technology for climate geoengineering. And they published a paper at the end of 2010 in Nature Communications where they said, oh, we can you know, sustainably harvest enough biomass from the surface of the earth that we could draw down the global greenhouse gas emissions by 12% annually.
Who's they?
They being members of the IBI, the International Biochar Initiative, and the authors of this paper. So you know, they have a very large-scale vision of promoting this, you know, on a very large scale, and they're seeking supports for it through the carbon markets, which would mean that biochar would be offered up as essentially as an offset for polluters. So the prime example right now, they've submitted a biochar methodology to the Alberta Offset Scheme, which is mostly geared towards offsetting the tar sands emissions, the emissions from tar sands extraction in Alberta, which is one of the worst, most destructive, most polluting projects on the surface of the earth. And they're saying, you know, you could use, bury some biochar in the ground to offset that pollution, which is really pretty outrageous given how little we know about the reliability of biochar, for one thing. And secondly, given that offsetting pollution is not a viable, you know, viable approach to dealing with the climate crisis at this point. We need to actually get rid of those emissions and those sources of pollution.
So the International Biochar Initiative is proposing that Alberta's tar sands be offset with biochar?
Well, there's members of the International Biochar Initiative who are involved with that. The funding for that is actually coming from ConocoPhillips and the Carbon War Room, Richard Branson, who's, you know, a biofuels entrepreneur. That's where the funding for developing standards for biochar and for developing this methodology for the Alberta offset scheme is coming from. They're looking for, you know, inexpensive ways to offset that massive polluting destructive project, and thinking that biochar might be one of them.
So if they were to proceed with this biochar offset scheme for Alberta's tar sands, where exactly do they propose to bury all of this biochar, and how much wood and other biomass would they need to burn to offset the tar sands?
That's a really good question, and it would be really monumental. The reality is that when you make biochar, somewhere around 12 to maybe, if you're lucky, up to 40% of the carbon in the wood that you use or the other biomass is retained in the charcoal. So the rest of it goes off into both a gaseous form and an oil form. And that can be used for bioenergy if it's further used. But the point is just that only a small portion of the carbon in that initial, you know, say you take one tree, only 12 to 40% of the carbon in the tree will be retained in the char. Mm-hmm. So, and it takes a lot of char to sequester any significant amount of carbon in the soil, assuming that you believe that it'll actually stay in the soil, which so far the evidence doesn't even support that. So it would take massive amounts of land. I mentioned before this study that was published in Nature Communications where they said, you know, the theoretical potential for biochar of drawing down 12% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And hidden in the very fine print in the supplementary materials and through, in, you know, searching out the references, we eventually concluded that actually what they were calling for was the conversion of 556 million hectares of land to biochar feedstock production. So, you know, this is part of this general blueprint that people have been using for making assessments and decisions about how to make, you know, not only biochar but biofuels in general, where the assumptions are that there's massive amounts of land that are, you know, available to produce feedstocks for these visions, be it biochar or biofuels or biomass, electricity, whatever. And they basically sort of look at the surface of the earth and they say, oh, there's, you know, millions of hectares of land. Usually it's in Africa and in Latin America that's available for us to grow our feedstocks and make the materials that are needed. It's just not a very realistic vision.
So 556 million hectares is what? How would you compare that to, say, the size of India?
I think it's larger than India, actually, 556 million hectares.
So there have been 11 field trials, according to your report that has just come out. And the name of your report is?
It's called Biochar, A Critical Review of Science and Policy.
So there have been 11 field trials that exist of biochar, and only five have looked at what happens to the soil carbon when biochar is added. in your mind, is this not adequate, that, you know, that there have been 11 field trials and only 5 looking at soil carbon? Or is this sort of standard operating procedure for scientists to move forward in this fashion?
It's certainly not standard operating procedure for scientists to propose really scaling up any technology on the basis of such limited knowledge, and especially given that even just the small number of studies, those 5, don't even have consistent results that support the claims that are being made about biochar being stable in soils for hundreds to thousands of years. Those claims are based on drawing an analogy with the terra preta soils from the Amazon, which are soils that were created by indigenous people in the Amazon, you know, hundreds and thousands of years ago. And they used charcoal in those soils, but they also used a lot of other materials. There's pottery shards and animal bones and compost and human waste and various other things also in those soils. And the process for creating those soils is something we don't know how that was done. But now, even, you know, thousands of years later, those soils are very fertile and have a lot of charcoal retained in them. Mm. But modern biochar, just producing some char through a pyrolysis process and burying it in the soil, is not the same process.
Now, one of the topics that you explore in your report is the notion that biochar is actually has ancillary benefits for the poor, that both it helps sequester carbon in soils, but it also creates, as you've been suggesting, soil fertility, and for subsistence farmers in the developing world, this is a good thing. Talk about how biochar is being promoted as sort of a poverty alleviation approach to addressing agricultural shortages in the developing world.
Right. Well, as you know, there's a lot of interest now in agriculture in general and in trying to sort of ramp up production in places like Africa where the food crisis is so severe. And biochar is just one of the technologies that's kind of in the mix, I guess I would say. It's been promoted on a couple of different fronts. One is that it's been promoted, you know, just as a way of improving soil fertility and therefore improving crop yields for people. And there's been a number of different trials that have been done. And these are not really scientific trials. They're just kind of, you know, small-scale trials done by different groups. So there's been a number of trials. Actually, we looked at, for example, we did a bit of a review of projects in Africa and found that I think there were something like 28 relatively small-scale trials happening around in Africa on biochar. And, you know, these are presented very much as being beneficial to the poor. You know, some of these trials also are based on the assumption that slash-and-burn agriculture is a leading cause of deforestation and that we should try and address that by replacing slash-and-burn with slash-and-char agriculture. If you were to take the materials that would have been burned and instead make biochar out of them and put the char in the soils will stay fertile for longer, and the need to clear more forest will be postponed or even halted if you're really lucky. So again, this is based, again, on the assumption that putting biochar in the soil is, in fact, going to improve the soil fertility, when there's not that much evidence to support that claim in the first place. There's also, you know, the underlying assumption that slash-and-burn agriculture is a leading cause of deforestation. I mean, there's no question that it's problematic in some places, but there's also no question that deforestation is more a problem of industrial forestry practices and excessive demand for wood products in the developed world rather than these very, very poor farmers who are eking out a living on the edges of the forest and practicing slash-and-burn agriculture. But in any case, again, it's based on the assumption that it's going to improve soil fertility, which is not necessarily a good assumption. Another place where we see the pro-poor biochar promotion is in cookstoves. Cookstoves that produce biochar have been promoted as being more efficient and cleaner. And they're certainly probably more efficient and cleaner than just cooking on an open cook fire. But the real comparison should be with other efficient cookstoves. And as I said before, if you make biochar, you retain some portion of the carbon in the material as char, which means in a cookstove context, that means that that amount of that biomass did not go into cooking energy. It was retained as char instead. So relative to other cookstoves that would have used the entire content of the biomass as cook energy, they're less efficient.
And they're promoted, you know, also again on the basis of the idea that, well, these farmers, you know, it's cleaner, it's more efficient, and then they will have this wonderful material, this char residue, which they can put back in the soils, which will help them to grow more biomass so that they can continue cooking with that. But cooking on a cook stove produces a very, very, very small amount of char. And we did some calculations just to look at, you know, how much char would be produced from by these cook stoves and how long it would take. And it would take a family, you know, years to produce enough biochar to add to just improve the soils in 1 hectare of land. It would take them years and years of cooking 3 times a day to get enough biochar, because it takes, you know, several tons of biochar to get any impact on the soils. And in places where it has shown some improvement in the soils, it takes a large amount to do that. So these cook stoves are not going to produce enough biochar to actually really influence the productivity of the land for these people.
So what would you recommend instead? Would you recommend gas stoves with fossil fuels, or would you recommend biogas stoves? Or what are the alternatives that are better for the environment, better for the poor, better for cooking?
Well, there's no question that more efficient stoves are needed and are a good solution. It's just a question of which stoves are the most efficient. And advocating for a biochar producing stove as being a good option is not necessarily, you know, the best choice. Mm-hmm. Again, if you have an efficient stove that uses biomass but uses all of the energy from the biomass for cooking, then that's probably a better option than making biochar.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of slash and burn agriculture, one of the things that rarely gets mentioned when people condemn slash and burn agriculture in the Amazon is the role of biofuels, in particular sugarcane and other fuels that are being turned into energy for automobiles in that slash and burn agriculture. I wonder if you can just speak quickly on that topic.
The extension of the agricultural frontiers almost always is coming at the expense of forested land at this point. So if there's more demand for plant biomass, mm-hmm. for fueling cars, for making biochar, for fueling an entire bioeconomy where we substitute plant biomass as a source of energy for virtually everything that we use fossil fuels for now, all of that has to come out of, you know, at the expense of some other land.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the funding that's going towards some of these biochar initiatives involving cook stoves and other trials to try to sequester carbon in the soil, where is most of the money coming from?
Well, surprisingly, they've been looking for that and have so far not really been too successful. I think the main focus was in trying to get biochar accepted into some of the carbon trading schemes. Mm-hmm. There was a push within the UN to get biochar accepted in, for example, into the Clean Development Mechanism and get carbon finance through that. So far, that hasn't been successful. There's been methodologies submitted, as I said, to the Alberta Offset Scheme and to a number of other, the Verified Carbon Standard and other carbon trading schemes, with the idea that this would be the way to get funding to scale up biochar production. But so far, that funding hasn't been forthcoming, and there's a lot of question about how the future of carbon markets in general. So the biochar lobby has been kind of shifting their focus lately to a kind of a broader approach, that biochar has all these different benefits, you know, reducing fertilizer use and doing helping soils to retain water and all these other things, which they claim to be the case, whether there's any scientific evidence for that or not. But so they're seeking to kind of broaden the vision away from just sequestering carbon, but to all these other roles that they believe biochar could play. And they're doing that in part because there's increasing discussions about how agriculture could be brought into the carbon markets in general and is receiving a lot of funding through various different initiatives. And this would mean funding would come in for promoting carbon or climate-friendly agriculture practices. The enthusiasts are hoping that biochar will be funded under that umbrella.
Did you want to mention the Gates Foundation or any of that stuff?
Yeah. One of the significant pieces of funding that has come through is from the Gates Foundation, which offered a large grant to Cornell University. Cornell University has played a lead role in the Green Revolution, the current Alliance for a Green Revolution for Africa. These agriculture initiatives are worrying because they promote a sort of a vision of improving agriculture practices, for example, in Africa, by introducing genetically modified crops and various other kind of intensive industrial monoculture practices, which they see as the way to improve productivity in places like Africa. Whereas there are a lot of other people who believe that what's needed is something quite different. What's needed is support for peasant agriculture, essentially, for very diverse agroecological, for local production, local consumption, not these industrial monocultures that are designed for providing feed for cattle for people on the other side of the planet, for example.
So what can people do, given that this is sort of in the realm of science and abstractions and pipe dreams for ConocoPhillips and others? How should people proceed?
Well, I think people just need to be really, really, really cautious about how things are presented as, you know, green alternatives and green solutions to problems. And, you know, when you think about it, it's really common sense. As these people are advocating that we use charcoal to cool down a warming planet. And that just, you know, when you think of it in those terms, it doesn't make sense. When you look around and you see, you know, what looks like a healthy planet is a place that's got a nice, you know, healthy growing forest. It's not a place that has industrial monocultures for, you know, wood production. We know very well at this point that we need to restore and protect the ecosystems that we have remaining and hopefully improve on it, not create huge new demands for biomass as an alternative to fossil fuels.
Thanks for speaking with us today. I've been speaking with Rachel Smoker. She's the co-director of Biofuel Watch. They are just out with a recent report on biochar called A Critical Review of Biochar Science and Policy, which you can download from their website, biofuelwatch.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with interviews from Daphne Washam, host of Earthbeat Radio. As the producer of Radio EcoShock, I can tell you Daphne Washam is an American gem for reporting on the environment. We need her voice and the original stories she uncovers, like those you are hearing today. Find out how you can help at earthbeatradio.org. Let's get back to our second new interview from Daphne. Big corporations plan to industrialize our forests. They'll do it by changing the very nature of trees with genetic engineering. Unless we say no, here's Daphne Washam.
Ann Peterman is the executive director of the Global Justice Ecology Project. I'm speaking with her in Vermont at her home office. Ann, you have been working on the issue of genetically engineered trees. And I would venture a guess that most people don't realize that there is such a thing as genetically engineered trees. Tell us about your work.
Well, we've been working on the issue of genetically engineered trees since we first found out about them in 1999. And since then, the focus has really been trying to keep them out of the environment. So they've got, in the United States, is the country that's at the leading edge of pushing this technology globally. There have been over 300 test plots of genetically engineered trees in the United States and also elsewhere around the world, but mainly here. And that they're getting closer and closer to the point where they want to commercialize them. In other words, sell them by the billions for planting in mass monoculture tree plantations for a variety of purposes, from wood-burning electricity to paper to biomass-based products like chemicals and textiles and so forth. So anyway, the idea is that, from our perspective, is that this can never happen. These are far too dangerous, these trees, to let them out in the environment. And so we have been working, as the Stop GE Trees campaign, with attorneys from the Center for Food Safety and the Center for Biological Diversity to actually sue the USDA to try to stop a massive field trial that we believe is the next step that industry is taking toward commercialization. And the trees that they're looking at commercializing are actually eucalyptus trees, which, first of all, are not native to the North American continent or anywhere in the world except for Australia. But industry loves them because they're fast growing. And so they've been manipulating them to be cold tolerant so that they can actually grow all along the Gulf Coast of the United States, where they've never been able to grow before. And we believe it's very dangerous. Not only are these things very invasive, as anybody in California already knows, but they're extremely flammable, and they suck up a lot of groundwater. You know, wildlife can't live in these places, and yet, you know, international paper is talking about doubling the acreage of plantations in the Southeast from 42 million acres to 84 million acres using these genetically engineered eucalyptus trees.
What is so dangerous? I mean, obviously, eucalyptus trees sound like a particular class in themselves. I mean, they, as you've mentioned, they soak up a lot of water. They're fast growing. They alter the pH of the soil. What is another reason to be concerned about other types of genetically engineered trees?
Right. They started, I think, my theory is that industry started with the trying to commercialize eucalyptus trees because there aren't native eucalyptus trees in the North American forests. So they felt that they could cut off the contamination argument. Unfortunately, they were also very invasive. But, you know, putting that aside, that is a major concern about the other species of trees that they're engineering. So they're engineering pine trees, poplar trees, and assorted other trees with the idea of also releasing them commercially on a large scale at some point. And those trees have with them the problem of contamination. It's almost certain that they will eventually, the pollen and seeds will spread and they will contaminate native forests. And you won't be able to stop that once it starts. That's the thing. If you have poplar trees in a plantation and they start to contaminate the native forest, the native poplars in a forest with these genetically engineered traits, there's no way to know what trees those are, and there's no way to stop it. So it's an irreversible problem. And who knows what the impacts will be? They are engineering poplars, for example, to be insect resistant, which means that every cell in the tree contains the toxin, the BT toxin.
What is BT?
BT is a, it's a natural, it's actually a natural insecticide that
what
they've, Bacillus thuringiensis. And it's a natural pesticide that is used actually by organic gardeners, but biotechnologists have figured out how to take that gene and insert it unnaturally into plants so that they express this pesticide in every single gene of, excuse me, every single cell of the tree, which means that it will kill whatever insects try to eat the tree or plant. And so that's a very big problem when you talk about that escaping into a forest. Forests, obviously, insects are a crucial part of it. They're part of the web of life. Studies have also shown that wildlife that eat the insects that have eaten the BT, that it continues to have effect up the food chain. So, you know, what will be the effect on songbirds that are eating these caterpillars that have eaten this BT? We don't know. There are other traits that they're moving forward with, like reduced lignin. Lignin is what they need to take out to make paper and biofuels and so on. So they're trying to make these low lignin genetically engineered trees.
Okay, before you get on to lignin, just on the poplar trees and the BT insecticide that's sort of part and parcel of this genetically engineered tree. Why are these trees being genetically engineered in this fashion? What's the ultimate goal here?
The goal, well, the goal of the BT is that you can have a mass plantation of the exact same tree and it won't be infested with insects. And that's been a big problem with some of these monocultures. They, for example, in China, they were combating desertification with these massive poplar plantations, and they found that they were being completely wiped out by insects. And so, you know, the UN stepped in and said, well, we can help you with that. Let's try some BT poplars. And so now they have these, you know, millions of BT trees growing across China. They haven't documented where they are. The Nanjing Institute of Environmental Science in 2005 released a report saying that they were already contaminating the native poplars. So, yeah, I mean, you know, they want to be able to use the industrial agriculture model on forests and have these massive plantations of the exact same species and not have to worry about insect infestations, which is the natural, you know, foe, I guess you could say, of that type of monoculture.
Now, you were about to mention lignin, and you also mentioned pine trees as another type of tree that is being genetically engineered. Is the lignin being engineered out of pine trees? Is that what's happening?
Pine is actually the tree that they're using more for improving wood quality. So, because pine is what's largely used for construction material. So trying to reduce the branching in pine trees, also making them insect resistant, improving the wood quality. And so, I mean, basically, if they could grow 2x4s in the forest, that would be their ideal. But yeah, so that's kind of a different series of things that they're doing. But they also use pines for paper. So I don't recall if they're doing low lignin pines. They probably are. But they're definitely doing low lignin poplars for paper. And the thing about lignin is that it's what It's what protects trees from animal browsing, from wind, from cold, from environmental stresses. It's basically what protects a tree from all of the different elements that may impact it. And so when you reduce the lignin, which you have to do to make them more easily pulped for paper or turned into all of these other products, you just don't know what the impacts are going to be when you put that out in the wild. Is the first windstorm going to wipe them out, or, you know, are they going to spread their pollen and seeds into the forest and create very weak versions of that tree in the forest that then have unknown impacts on the forest? Low lignin trees also store less carbon in the trees themselves. 70% less carbon in the trees themselves, 30% less carbon in the soil. So they're and they rot more quickly, releasing the carbon back into the atmosphere very quickly. So they're sort of, if we're talking about trees and climate change, they're sort of going in the exact wrong direction as far as what we need to do in terms of reforestation for sequestering carbon in forests.
Now, I had heard that they were trying to genetically engineer pine trees in Sweden in order to reduce the lignin content in the native pine forest there, because they had developed biodigesters that essentially took pine trees and turned the pine pulp into a kind of biofuel. Is that something that you know about and could speak to?
They wanted the second generation biofuel technology is very much focusing on trees because they are one of the most reliable feedstocks. You can harvest them year round, whereas many of the grasses, miscanthus and switchgrass and so on that they're looking at with biofuels, often you can't harvest them year round. So you have a part of the year where you have no feedstock supply to manufacture the liquid fuels. But the technology problem is very serious. They cannot figure out how to economically transform cellulose from trees into liquid fuels. And that's one of the reasons that they're genetically engineering them to have low lignin, is then they'll be more easily digested into liquid fuels. One of the other technologies that they're looking at is actually putting an enzyme, genetically engineering an enzyme into the tree so it can start to digest itself prior to cutting it down and, again, enhance the process. So, they really would like to have trees made into liquid fuels and electricity and textiles and plastics and so forth using these genetic engineering technologies, but there's a lot of technological hurdles that they need to get over first, and I really don't think they're going to be able to do that.
If you've just joined us, I'm Daphne Wesham. This is Earthbeat. We're speaking with Ann Peterman. She's the Executive Director of Global Justice Ecology Project. We're discussing the issue of genetically engineered trees for use both as biofuels and for other uses that industry sees fit to engineer them for. For example, eucalyptus that are fast-growing. What is the main purpose of these fast-growing eucalyptus trees for industry?
Right now, it's mainly pulp. So pulp for paper, pulp for cardboard. And now they're starting to move into the biomass area of burning wood for electricity. The UK, for example, is really barreling ahead with using trees to produce electricity. So that's the new thing on the horizon for forests, is burning them for electricity. There's not much technology that you need to be able to do that. It's pretty much already there.
So one of the things that many of us will notice if we pick up our electricity bill, we'll see that our local utility is switching from coal to biomass as a form of electricity. Is this a positive development? Is it a negative development? How common is it across the United States?
There are many, many proposals across the United States in many different states to create more biomass burners, to start switching over coal-fired power plants to biomass, or in other words, trees, to produce the electricity, and to start constructing new biomass facilities. In most of the cases, these are being very heavily fought by local grassroots organizations that see these biomass plants as a major threat to forests, and they are. They consume an enormous amount of wood per megawatt, and many of these plants are quite large. They're servicing large areas of population. So the threat to forests is quite extensive, especially when you look at the cumulative impact of all of these plants. And then there's the carbon problem. People argue that these plants are carbon neutral, that, you know, we're burning the wood, but we're also growing trees to replace them. But when you look at the real analysis of the pollution coming out of these things, it's a very serious problem. There's a lot of health impacts associated with burning wood, all of the different particulates that are in the air. It's one of the dirtiest forms of energy that there is. And carbon-wise, if you look at the full life cycle of harvesting the trees, transporting them, and then burning them, they actually produce even more carbon emissions than coal. So overall, environmentally, biomass burners are not a very good alternative to coal.
So what can be done? We have genetic engineering of trees on an experimental level and apparently on a mass scale here in the United States. What can be done by people that are concerned about this issue?
Well, at this point, the GE trees have not been commercialized in the United States. They're still in the testing phase. The USDA is currently considering an application by a genetically engineered tree company for commercialization of genetically engineered eucalyptus. They will be sued. I know that for a fact because we will sue them. And, so it's going to be a long time before they ever get these trees actually commercialized. But what people can do is to write the USDA, and people can do that from our website. They can sign our petition to the USDA saying we don't want genetically engineered trees in the United States. We don't want them commercialized here. We don't even want them in test plots here, because that means once they perfect them, they'll put them somewhere else in the world. We don't want that either. So people can sign on to our petition, or they can write to the USDA directly and say we do not want genetically engineered trees. You can learn more from our website, all kinds of things that people can do. There's a video. There's a short 5-minute little clip that we made for last year's International Day Against Monoculture Timber Plantations. There's all kinds of things.
And the website is?
The website is nogetrees.org.
Great. Well, thanks so much for speaking with us today. Ann Peterman, Executive Director of Global Justice Ecology Project. Any final words?
Stop GE Trees.
Thank you.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm glad you're here to join us. That website for genetic engineering of trees and how to stop wild trees from being industrialized is nogetrees.org. Nogetrees.org. We are showcasing interviews by Daphne Wysham, host of Earthbeat Radio. That program is reorganizing. Find out more at earthbeatradio.org. Wrapping up today, who could have predicted 3 Japanese reactors would melt down, spraying that country with radioactivity? Some radioactive particles arrived in North America and in Europe. Helen Caldicott warned us about this for years that this could happen. Here is an interview where Daphne Wysham talks in studio with Dr. Helen Caldicott on October 22, 2009.
Joining me at the offices of the Institute for Policy Studies is Dr. Helen Caldicott. She's a pediatrician and the co-founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, as well as the group Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament. She has spent nearly 40 years writing and researching the dangers of nuclear radiation. She's the author of the book Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. Thanks so much for joining us today, Helen.
That's a pleasure.
Let's start with the health impacts of nuclear power. Dr. Caldicott, could you give us an overview of the dangers?
Well, we mustn't forget that nuclear power is the prodigal son of nuclear weapons, and it's the same energy released inside nuclear power plants, E equals MC squared, as released when you blow up a bomb. The mining of uranium is dangerous. It's radioactive, and I haven't got time to go through all the daughters of uranium. Suffice it to say, one of them is radium that gave Madame Curie leukemia and her daughter leukemia. It's dangerous to mine uranium. In the past, 30 to 50% of men who've mined uranium have died of lung cancer. And also, they're exposed to low-level whole-body radiation, so their testicles get irradiated, which are the most important organs in a male body in terms of evolution and genetic disease. The uranium passes through a series of processes to be made into fuel rods and packed into a reactor. When the reactor, 100 tons are put in a reactor, the moderating rods are lifted out and the whole thing reaches critical mass. It doesn't explode, but atoms start breaking apart spontaneously. 200 new elements are formed, man-made. Some last seconds, some last millions of years. The reactor can't operate without routinely releasing radioactive materials into the air and into the water. A new study done by Germans, and they're very meticulous, looked at 16 reactors and children under five years of age, less than 5K from the reactors, and found more than double the increased incidence of leukemia, and their cancers are higher too. And this is a pretty definitive study supported by various meta-analyses that have been done. Not many people do epidemiological studies because they're very expensive, they're time-consuming, the government doesn't want to pay for them, neither does the nuclear industry, because I'd rather not find out what's going on. Now, apart from living near a reactor being dangerous, and I could go into the various elements, but I won't, but, you know, if you live near a reactor, your food's going to be somewhat radioactive, as it imbibes tritium, which is a potent carcinogen, and other elements. The main thing about nuclear power is the production of massive quantities of radioactive waste, which must be stored isolated from the environment, according to the EPA, for about 250,000 years. That is a physical and scientific impossibility. So far, the nuclear industry, just in America, has made about 64,000 tons of this stuff. It sits in cooling pools, some atop the reactors on their roofs, open possibly to terrorist attack. A reactor contains as much radiation as 1,000 Hiroshima bombs, but the cooling pools storing the radioactive waste over years contain 2 to 30 times more radiation than in the reactor core. So they're open to terrorist attacks, and a meltdown in a cooling pool would be catastrophic, according to a study at Princeton University by von Hippel and others. The reactor itself is dangerous. It could melt down. We've had two major meltdowns, one just 13 miles from Hershey's Chocolates. I won't go into all of that, but I advise people as a doctor not to eat Hershey's Chocolates. They're only 13 miles as the crow flies from Hershey's. There was such a release of radiation, the monitors went off scale within the first few minutes. So no one knows how much got out.
And this was where?
This was in Pennsylvania, in Three Mile Island. At Pennsylvania, and Hershey's is just next door, and they built two huge reactors in the middle of the richest dairying area of America. I mean, what? I can't understand why anyone would do that. Anyway, apart from a meltdown, which could, well, a meltdown near New York, Indian Point, which is 35 miles from the center of Manhattan, could kill thousands of people acutely in the first week, vomiting, bleeding to death, and losing their hair. And then 5 years later, there'd be an epidemic of leukemia, depending upon which way the wind blows. But say it blows towards New York, and then an epidemic of solid cancer. It could kill 800,000 people or more. If the terrorists had flown into the two Indian Point reactors instead of the two World Trade Towers, they would have destroyed the richest financial city in the world. They didn't, because they thought that the reactors were protected by missiles. No reactors are protected by anything. And, you know, Sweden got to within about 2 minutes of a major meltdown like Chernobyl a couple of years ago. So it's not if but when. The possibility, according to a nuclear engineer, is about 1 in 10 in America in the next 10 years. Now, apart from that, the radioactive waste, which is leaking in various parts of the country, the elements like strontium-90 that causes bone cancer and leukemia last for 600 years, cesium that causes brain cancer, muscle cancers, various cancers, last 600 years, plutonium which causes lung cancer, liver cancer, bone cancer, leukemia, damages the developing embryo so it's born grossly deformed, and actually concentrates in testicles, damaging the genes in the sperm, that lasts for 500,000 years. And that's, you know, that's just a few elements in the radioactive waste. And it's leaking now, and these elements bioconcentrate back in the food chain, as in algae, crustaceans, little fish, big fish, humans, or grass, cows, cow's milk, breast milk, babies. So you can't dilute radioactive waste. The solution to pollution by dilution is fallacious when it comes to radiation. And we as physicians predict, and I just addressed the National Academy of Pediatrics a couple of days ago in Washington, D.C., we predict epidemics of malignancy, particularly in children who are very radiosensitive, and epidemics of genetic diseases, of which there are now 23,000 described, for virtually the rest of time. And it's very important to know that all other species have genes, they get cancer, and they develop genetic abnormalities too. So we're talking about one of the biggest, or the biggest public health hazard the world will ever see, but we'll all be dead. It will be after we've died. That's the legacy we leave to our future descendants so we can turn our lights on for a few years. We're running out of uranium. I mean, this is a really crazy but very, very medically dangerous industry. It's a cancer-inducing industry and it's a bomb-making industry because any country that buys a reactor can make a bomb from the plutonium generated. So it increases the threat of nuclear war as well.
Well, that's quite a summary of the severe health impacts of nuclear power. Dr. Helen Caldicott, we're often hearing that nuclear power supplies energy without adding to the problem of climate change. I wonder if you can walk us through that claim.
Yes, I address this issue in the first chapter of my book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming. If you look at the industrial infrastructure that underlies a nuclear power plant, a lot of CO2 is created, not as much as coal, but a lot is. I come from Australia where 40% of the world's uranium resides, and you should see the size of the trucks. They're just ginormous, and the huge shovels, and you can just see the smoke pouring out. A huge amount of fossil fuel is used to mine uranium. Then it has to be crushed in a big crusher, more fossil fuel. And then it's interesting, it goes to Paducah, Kentucky, our uranium, where there are two 1,500 megawatt coal-fired plants to enrich the uranium. Coal-fired plants pour out CO2. And interestingly, CFC gases are used to cool the pipes containing a very thermally hot uranium hexafluoride. Those pipes are old. There are hundreds of miles of these pipes. They're cracking. And the nuclear industry has been grandfathered out of the Montreal Protocol because CFC must not be released. It's also 10 to 20,000 times more potent as a global warmer than CO2. So the nuclear industry is adding considerably to adding CFCs to the atmosphere, both which will destroy ozone and add to global warming. Then you have to build a reactor. It's a great big concrete thing. So to say that nuclear power is clean and green is a lie. It produces CO2, it produces global warming, and it produces massive quantities of radioactive waste, which over time are going to produce epidemics of diseases like we've never seen before. And, you know, most mutations now are called deleterious. They cause disease, and my specialty is cystic fibrosis, the most common genetic fatal disease of childhood. And to think of those diseases increasing in time because we're filling our environment up with radioactive isotopes is almost beyond me to talk about. And this is, as I say consistently, this is an issue of global preventive medicine, and we must shut the nuclear industry down. I really don't care. I mean, global warming is very serious, but we know absolutely that all energy now can be produced with renewable energy sources without any nuclear. I almost don't know what to say except that when my colleagues, pediatricians, hear the story about what it means genetically and in terms of malignancy, they are just absolutely struck dumb. They don't know what to do. And if we have a disease that is incurable, the only recourse is prevention. And here we are trying to treat cancer patients, breast cancer week and the like. Cancer's increasing. Radiation's still falling out from the fallout from the weapons testing days, let alone from these reactors. So it's the whole thing is antithetical to people being healthy down the generations.
Now, France, of course, relies quite a bit on nuclear power for its energy needs, as do other countries like Japan. And I wonder if you can talk about how they deal with their waste and how they manage the expense of nuclear power.
Well, they don't really know what to do with their radioactive waste. Wasn't there an article recently that France is sending some of its radioactive waste to one of the ex-Russian countries?
Yeah.
It also puts some of its radioactive waste in the sea. Well, that's great because it'll contaminate the fish. Fish swim thousands of miles. You can't taste or smell or see radioactive waste in the fish. And when you get your cancer, maybe 20 years later, because the incubation time for cancer is long, it doesn't wear a little sign saying what it made it, like some strontium-90 in a piece of fish you ate 20 years ago that came from French reactors. Now, the French are pretty arrogant. I've got a French son-in-law who's a count. His sister is a model, but she's also a very famous TV commentator. She knows nothing about nuclear power. Most French don't. The nuclear power industry is totally controlled and run by the French government, and Le Monde's been pretty well subjected to, you know, what the French government says in terms of nuclear power. When I met Mitterrand years ago, he said he would close down the reactors if he got to be president, but of course he didn't. And the French haven't done any studies, epidemiological studies, like the Germans, looking at the incidence of malignancy around their reactors. So the French are really digging a hole for themselves genetically and in terms of malignancy, and they love their food. And some of their food is going to be radioactive, and their wine. And apart from that, when Chernobyl occurred, it made 40% of the European landmass radioactive. I don't buy European food because you don't know what batches are radioactive and what are not. I'm very careful about what I buy. I rang the man in Melbourne, Australia, who tests the food imported from Europe. And I said, what do you do? How do you test it? And he said, well, the computer picks up random batches. That means a lot is not tested. And I said, well, what do you do when you find radioactive food? He said, oh, we dilute it with non-radioactive food. Well, I've just described you can't dilute it. It reconcentrates back in the body. So, you know, just to think that one accident contaminated a whole continent is just almost beyond belief. And it's going to happen again. And I may say that the next nuclear meltdown, if it's in a Western country like Europe or America, that will mark the end of nuclear power. That'll be it.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott in a studio interview with EarthBeat host Daphne Washam in October 2009. Find past programs and how you can help at earthbeatradio.org. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you for tuning in, and please, get active in your world. Casey Neal singing Hallowed Be Thy Ground from the album Songs for the Earth, a tribute to Rachel Carson, a great album available from www.musemusic.org.
His banana hail of western Tennessee, great central hardwoods of the Ozarks and the Shawnee. Fireflies illuminate the swamp at dark, exploding like embers, scattering like sparks. Forests are the finest refuge this body has known, and I'll stray away where the trail is overgrown, where the trail is overgrown. Hallowed be thy ground, and all your high mountains with glory crown. The play of a light through thickets of cottonwood, play a light on the river, on the banks where I've stood. Further west to the continental divide, where the mighty wild Rockies do thrust and collide. Scree sloping down the ridgeline to the valley below, lush alpine meadows where the arnica grows, arnica grows. Hallowed be thy ground, and holier blue ocean where the wild surfaces pound. Hallowed be thy ground, and all your high mountains with glory crown. Gotta run to the mountain, run to the mountain. Run to the mountain, run to the mountain, run to the mountain. carry with me every bear I've ever seen, every drainage, every rivulet, the twilight sheen of the wild inhabitations in the heart of hinterland. A dialect is spoken you can almost understand. The step of the seasons, the treasure of terrain, it has changed me so completely, I'll never be the same, never be the same.